this, Uncle Sam. I do not like his healthcare scam. I do not like... dirty crooks, or how they lie and cook the books. I do not like when Congress steals. I do not like their crony deals. I do not like this spying, man. I do not like, oh yes, we can. I do not like this spending spree. We're smart, we know there's nothing free. I do not like reporter smug replies when I complain about their lies.
That was Sarah Palin's take on green eggs and ham at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee convention that we'll be talking about here, among many other issues that we're going to in this national news roundup we have this hour. I don't know if former Governor Palin realizes what a left-winger Dr. Seuss really was, but...
But she was. It was well done. Was
I
well
don't
done,
think she well cares.
Done. Well done.
We're here with Dr. Richard Batch, Professor of Rhetoric and Communication at Towson University's Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development, author recently of The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Assistant Professor of American Studies at UMBC, author of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities, John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, co-author of Dollarocracy, How Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome all. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. We'll be covering what we just heard, CPAC convention, what happened with Senator Feinstein accusing the CIA of spying on computers, and more about the kind of spying in general, theories surrounding the death of Chokwe Lumumba and what he meant for this country as well, Keystone Pipeline, and maybe this missing airplane because nobody knows what to say. It's in the ocean and we have no idea why, where, or what.
Right.
All kinds of conspiracy theories abound. But John Nichols, why don't you lead us off with your take on Sarah Palin and the CPAC convention?
Well, look, she's the rock star of a CPAC convention for a variety of reasons. And you know what was interesting about that reading? I mean, it's actually, I think she did it quite well, as folks have been saying here. I think she would be rather shocked to learn that Dr. Seuss was a regular contributor to the great left-wing journals and debates of his time. But I also thought there was something interesting in the way that she presented that. And I think it spoke, to my mind, rather painfully to the reality of this year's CPAC. And that is that it was a very inward-looking kind of in-joke event where speaker after speaker tried to certainly rally the base and position, in many cases, for the 2016 presidential race. But there was little or nothing in the way of new ideas, new messaging. And I mean, I know this sounds naive, but you would think when all or just about all of the great conservative leaders of our time come together that it would be an innovative event, that it would have some ideas, and that they would, you know, really dig deep into, for instance, some of the dialogue that has gone on about, you know, whether and how this party should build beyond what in 2012 certainly looked like a very narrow base. So that's a starting point, and then I assume we will rather quickly get into Paul Ryan's.
We're gonna play that clip as well in just a little bit, Paul Ryan's clip about the brown lunch bag and more. But Rick,
well, I you know every every so many years I hear people complaining about no new ideas, and it's just forgive me, but it just leaves me cold. I mean, the question is, what are the ideas that will take this country forward and help this country in the areas of the economy, foreign policy? And I think there is trouble in the Republican Party. I think there's trouble because they are so lacking in unity. I think there are internecine fights that will redound to the detriment of the party. I don't think they have a candidate yet around whom they can hope to win a presidential election. But I think that the country is in terrible shape, especially in foreign policy, but also in domestic policy under the president. I think the president does not even appreciate the fact that to have a Jimmy Carter foreign policy is going to hurt this country in the long run. I think that this is not to say that the specific application to the Ukraine means that he should have done X, Y, or Z to prevent it, but I think that.
Well, let's say we see back for a moment.
Right.
My point is that the good news for the Democrats is that there is tremendous internecine fighting among the Republicans, and that there's no consensual candidate for the presidency. The good news for the Republicans is that I think they're finally understanding that they've got to win elections, not just rally the most intense supporters.
I think I agree with everything Richard just said, because I thought it was well said. And it's exactly my stance on what I saw taking place at CPAC is there was this rallying around these exciting statements being made, but there wasn't much depth to it. And so I'm not interested in new ideas because I don't think anybody has any new ideas as of late. I think it's a regurgitation of the same old, same old, as it has been for a number of presidential terms and number of years. So that doesn't situate itself with just this current administration. I mean, I think it's been going on for a while at this point. But I do think I was really interested in the energy around Rand Paul in particular, and I am actually interested in seeing what comes of that, especially with some of the ideas that he has, to see if it comes to fruition that we continue to have this energy behind him or if it falls flat because he is seen as too much or too extreme for some.
And I'm going to come right back to the Rand Paul issue. As soon as we hear this Ryan, the Paul Ryan clip, I'm going to come back to Rand Paul. But one of the things, again, we talk about no new ideas. John Nichols, I mean, some of the things you've been writing lately, there's this awesome underlying premise that you're looking at in terms of Democratic Party that I think suffers from the same problem.
Exactly.
Of no new ideas and no kind of push for an agenda, kind of being stuck in this rut of the middle.
Yeah.
Well, that's my point. And, of course, I love my fellow guests but disagree with them completely. I think there are tons of new ideas out there. And there are actually many conservatives and many progressives who are talking about innovative approaches and approaches, and perhaps we use the wrong term when we say new ideas. Perhaps what we really mean is ideas and approaches that are responses, appropriate responses to the moment we are in.
That's fine.
And
yeah.
I found CPAC to be exceptionally disappointing in that regard because, except for a few lines, you could have come to CPAC last year or the year before that and heard the same speeches. And, you mentioned Rand Paul. It's striking, of course. Rand Paul did very, very well, but the Paul family always does well.
Right.
Because a lot of libertarians show up. What was missing at CPAC, to my view, was a great big centerpiece speech by Justin Amash, the very libertarian, much more libertarian than Rand Paul, congressman from Michigan, who has worked very closely with John Conyers, the senior, one of the senior Democrats in Congress, one of the great icons of the civil rights movement, on a host of spying, government, privacy, openness issues. And what I think is missing in our discourse, frankly, are Republicans and Democrats in high-profile positions who are talking about the fact that most Americans actually agree on a whole bunch of issues. Instead, I thought CPAC, and I think the Sarah Palin tape very well illustrated it, was kind of going to the most cliched areas of difference and objection and, you know, frustration, complaint about not being covered well by the media or things of that nature. And so, you know, I found this to be, I will say as strongly as I can, a very desultory and disappointing CPAC.
Let me play this quick tape from Paul Ryan and then go to a caller, Russ, after that. 410-319-8888. Russ, you are the first caller in line, and this is the Paul Ryan clip we need to talk about a bit as well.
The left is making a big mistake here. What they're offering people is a full stomach and an empty soul. The American people want more than that. You know, this reminds me of a story I heard from Eloise Anderson. She serves in the cabinet of my buddy, Governor Scott Walker. She once met a young boy from a very poor family. And every day at school, he would get a free lunch from a government program. He told Eloise he didn't want a free lunch. He wanted his own lunch, one in a brown paper bag, just like the other kids. He wanted one, he said, because he knew a kid with a brown paper bag had someone who cared for him. This is what the left does not understand.
Left may not understand that, but what they do understand is that she was talking about a book. Right. By Laura Schroff called The Invisible Thread.
Right.
And this incident never occurred.
Yeah. Yeah, Paul Ryan, who generally vets everything, did not check on his story. And he then apologized, and he should have checked on his story. But I think it has fewer lessons than others think. I think Paul Ryan is generally, with the exception of a flub here and there, I think he's generally a very, very intelligent, articulate conservative candidate.
Folks, John, go ahead.
I'm sad to report that that's not the case. I've known Paul all my life. My dad went to law school together, and I don't bear him any ill will, but he desperately, painfully needs a new speechwriter. When he had his great moment in The Sun, and he accepted the Republican nomination for vice president, he delivered a speech that is still remembered as one of the most fact-checked and fact-failed speeches in major oratory in America. He claimed that a factory in his hometown closed because of Obama, but actually the closing had begun when Bush was president, things of this nature. It was just a disastrous, embarrassing speech where he was called out at you know, literally paragraph after paragraph. And once again, he's fallen into this trap. And, you know, the painful thing about it is Paul Ryan, I think, is one of the few people who's really striving to go to bigger places, to have bigger dialogue. And, unfortunately, he gets tripped up by his faith, his belief, his certainty in a lot of these talking points. And one of the worst of the talking points is this notion that somehow feeding people who don't have access to enough food or have a hard time getting it at certain times of the day, feeding people is somehow going to make them weak. And so I think that the bigger issue is not that he quoted, or, you know, that not that he quoted from somebody who said something that was perhaps not the case. The bigger issue was that he so easily believed that. And I think it made him look, I don't want to say silly, that's too mean, but I think it was very embarrassing for him, and I think that his speech was a deeply, deeply disappointing address from someone who probably in that whole mix should have been the person calling them to a higher ground.
And I actually took a different approach on this because I was disturbed by kind of this religious ideology of who knows best. Like, as a conservative, I know what an empty soul looks like, and it comes through the form of what the left is doing to provide food for those who can't have. So that really troubled me, even more so than the stigma that is being associated with receiving this free lunch. Let's have that conversation of how in partisan politics that we seem to divide or create this divide of who knows best in terms of our religious beliefs or our religious stance or how we are to live our lives as so-called religious or Christian individuals in this country.
Where to start? All right, let me start back a little bit. Every time supporters of our president get frustrated, they say, "Don't pay attention to any of the larger issues." The Republicans talk on the conservatives talk often about media interpretation. So what's the answer? What's the answer to that? Are the media in fact disinterested? No. Let's stop talking about the media. Do we always have to talk about the media? The fact is that the media focus on various issues. They misrepresent them, and this isn't all the media. It's some of the media. And the fact, for example, when you have Barack Obama misspelling respect, is that a big deal? No. But it's a big deal. It was a big deal when Quayle did it. It's not such a big deal when Barack Obama does it. Everything is always a big deal when Republicans do it. It's a small deal when Democrats do it. I think on the issue of Paul Ryan's misstatement, and I agree it's a misstatement, I think the issue is what the Republicans have talked about all along, and that is there is a single major, major issue with respect to government and dependency. And the more you make people dependent, the more you rob them of the zeal to become better in our society. And all we do is we tend to look at how can we make people more and more dependent on government. And that is the major issue. You can look at small errors they make and focus on those errors all you want. And part of that is because media do that. But I'm telling you that this misses the big picture and it misses the issues that are relevant, should be relevant. I'm not saying will be relevant, but should be relevant in a presidential race of 2016.
And I agree with that point. But my bigger issue, again, is how then do we end up making the connection between these empty stomachs being also empty souls? So that trying to conflate those two pieces together is my problem.
That's right. You know, there are all kinds of people who don't use the best example in making a general point. But I think what Paul Ryan would say if he were not speaking to many, many, many people and trying to get laughs and win over intense supporters, you know, is that whenever you have a system that encourages dependency, you have a system which robs people of their ability to do better on their own, to be independent.
If I might just throw in here for one,
yeah, John,
second.
Then we'll go to the phones. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, just to throw in, I think that what's being said here is very, very important because I believe strongly that Paul Ryan was a victim of media here. He was a victim of consuming a lot of media that perpetuates fantasies about a dependency and food stamps and things of that nature, rather than looking into it himself. And I think that's made his speech very disappointing and makes him a weaker communicator, a weaker player at a time when many conservative ideas should be put forward and could well be put forward here, but instead he falls into the silliest of cliches. And he didn't, you know, in this case here, he gives this speech, he talks about this kid not knowing that the kid he's talking about and the woman who wrote the book have been active supporters of a national group that's argued for expanding food stamps, expanding school lunch programs, not cutting them. And so, I mean, at the most basic level, you're going to talk about somebody, you're going to try and use them in a political speech. Why not figure out what they're saying and what they're thinking?
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Join this conversation. We'll be switching topics in about 2 minutes after this, but 410-319-8888. Russ, you're on the air. Welcome.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests.
Greetings.
As regards Mr. Ryan, isn't that the same Mr. Ryan that ran for vice president with Mitt Romney? They put their ideas before the entire country, and they got defeated rather soundly. So, yeah, wouldn't you think that if they're going to stay around, that they would need some new ideas? And this guy didn't even have the courage to come out on the stage to say, hey, I'm congratulating the president on his win. But I don't want to steal on Mr. Ryan, because I want to get back to what Richard said about Crimea and Ukraine.
Okay.
If you take the age of America and double it, you will still have a few hundred more years there of relationship between Crimea and the Ukraine. I mean, they're older than America by more times than that relationship, twice. Now, Boris Yeltsin, when the Union was dissolving in 94, tried to get slick and pass the financial responsibilities for Crimea to Ukraine. But he knew, and the world knew, that Russia has its national naval headquarters there, that their access to warm waters and that Black Sea ports are essential to their national interests. And I'll tell you this and leave it on this note. I think that Putin, like him or not, had more legitimate reasons for going into Crimea than Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney had for going into Iraq 10 years ago.
God.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Russ. Well, you know, we can take a couple of minutes here on the Ukraine. We have to do an entire program on that. But I think that what I'm going to posit here, and you all can chime in for just a minute, is that none of the media right now, it seems to me, that we read, most of the media that I read and listen to, don't take into the complexity or the history or the complexity of the situation.
I agree.
You know, that nobody really understands the history of Ukraine and how it was always divvied up between Russia and Poland and had brief times of independence, or that Crimea has always been part of Russia but was put into the Ukraine by the USSR so they could control the situation the way it wanted to. I mean, this is also the battles between the European Union and the West and their interest in Ukraine and Russia's interest in the Ukraine and how this is a centerpiece. And I think that, John, this is part of the problem. We don't really get under this thing to really understand it. We just kind of look at the headlines.
Well, I agree, and I think this is also what I think here's our point of unity as guests on this program. I think that there is a sense that you have to go deeper and talk about these issues in profound ways, but I also think that in addition to the details on the ground, remember, those details on the ground relate not just to Ukraine, but to many, many other countries and regions in that area. That is a reality of a place that has been through world wars and, creations of huge, powerful republics and states, and then the breaking up of those governances. But here's the thing that I think is also missing here. I don't think in the course of this that there is enough discussion about the values that we ought to bring to a moment like this. And I think one of the values should be that you don't invade a region and then say, well, we're doing it to free them, or we're doing it to allow them to have self-determination. Self-determination is very, very important. The United Nations talks about that a lot, and I think it's a really exceptional goal. But self-determination, when you have an occupying military force or even a threat of such, becomes incredibly problematic. And so that's a deeper discussion, and it cuts both ways. It will make some friends of George Bush unhappy. It will make some defenders of Vladimir Putin unhappy. But the bottom line is that we ought to be talking about some basic standards about how we allow people to determine their fate, and recognize that invasions are not a way to do that.
So I think, is it time for a break here? Yes, Rob? 1 minute, so real quick, Rick, you have to say something.
Well, I agree, but the fact is that, and we can talk about this after the break, the fact is that when you have a completely unintimidating president of the United States, you give license to expansionist leaders like Putin to expand, and I think we have the single most unintimidating president we've had since Jimmy Carter.
Very quickly, Kimberly.
I was going in another direction,
but
because that would not be my sense, and I actually value leadership of our country that is trying to do more conciliatory movement as a world power, instead of continuing to create divisions and to make sure that there is always a hierarchy of who is on top.
How's and that's that
been
out?
And that's been that has been consistent of what we have done since Jimmy Carter. And how did that work out is a good question as well. But where I was going, which Richard might also want to respond, is I find it interesting that in a period that has where we have the most access to information and news, that we seem to also be in the midst of the most propaganda in terms of from all sides, not just one side, but from all sides of actually what is happening on the grounds. Even with reporters who are present, the way in which we view situations gets interpreted in particular ways that when it gets reported back to us, it has a propaganda slant to it and isn't necessarily what is always true.
We are going to take a brief break and go out here for a moment, I think, with Charlie Parker, My Little Suede Shoes. He passed away on this day, one of the great saxophonists and composers that we ever produced in this country. And we'll come back. We're going to switch gears and look at Chakwe Lumumba, his legacy. The funeral just happened. Now conspiracy theories are rising up. But let's talk about what that might portend in terms of the real legacy of someone like Chakwe Lumumba. Stay with us. I think America could take a little lesson from Charlie Parker and his blue suede shoes and about how you can mix and marry all kinds of genres of music and put them together in one sound. Charlie Parker for president is what I say.
You're here.
We're here with Dr. Kimberly Moffitt from UMBC, Assistant Professor of American Studies, John Nichols, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine and editor, associate editor of Capital Times, author of Dollarocracy, co-author of Dollarocracy. Let me get that correct. Doc Rick Vatz. I changed your name.
That's right. I kind of like it.
Doc Rick Vatz?
Yeah. Old Doc Rick Vatz. I remember him well.
From Towson University, 410-319-8888 is the number here. And let me jump into this. I've been wanting to talk about this ever since I read the piece the other day and listened to what Louis Farrakhan had to say about the death of Chakwe Lumumba, but also reading John Nichols' very poignant piece in The Nation, and what the New York Times and the place have written about Chakwe, and the fact that we actually were in touch with his office and were setting up interviews with his office, and he passed away, to talk about his legacy from the 1960s and as a revolutionary, what that means to be a he still called himself a revolutionary, even as mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. But now we're in the midst of all this kind of conspiracy theory again around his death. So help us make sense of some of this. Kimberly, I'll start them and we'll go to John.
Sure. Many of the conspiracy theories, which sometimes I participate in, I haven't necessarily embraced in this instance. I do think it's unfortunate what happened to him, especially so soon in his tenure as mayor of Jackson. But what I appreciated about that short term was his ability to stand in a particular space, seeing himself as a militant of the 60s and 70s, but also seeing himself as someone that could bring some type of unity in Jackson together, especially for a city that's always been seen from the outside, in particular, as being so divided, that he seemed to make connections with various aspects of his electorate to hopefully bring change to Jackson. But, of course, that time was snuffed out very quickly.
John?
Sure. I'm delighted that we're talking about the mayor. And he was a remarkable figure. And I think that what is significant about Chakwe Lumumba operates on two levels. First off, he was a radical. He referred to himself as a revolutionary. And we ought to elect people who use those terms.
Yes.
Now and again, maybe quite often. We were founded by people who referred to themselves as radicals and revolutionaries. Certainly many of the people who decided that we had to address the issue of slavery in this country referred to themselves as radicals and revolutionaries, trade unionists that began to expand the economic promise of this country. So I think that he brought America at least in his small scale, in his one community, brought America back to a more open discussion of the kind of people that we elect. And here's what's really exciting about his brief tenure. Elected as a radical, elected as a militant, who beat the incumbent mayor and the choice of the business community in the primary, and then went on to get, I believe, 85% of the vote in the general election, he turned around, came into office, and immediately started operating on the level of ideas, mm-hmm. big ideas about how you put people back to work, how you invest in infrastructure. And what was fascinating was when he met with conservative Republican legislators, they were blown away. In fact, many of the much of the highest praise for this guy came from conservatives who said, you know, look, we had no idea what we were walking into with this fella. But what he was talking about was a lot of what's been done has failed on all sides. Here's how I disagree with you. We're not going to be on the same page on that, but here's a place where maybe we can do something. And he was so good at it, so good at reaching across all these lines, that when he went out and asked for a major tax increase to renew the infrastructure of his city and to start putting people to work in the city, start actually developing all sorts of innovative, really pioneering local initiatives for employment and other issues, other developments, he got over 90% of the vote. I mean, to lose this guy, who was, to my mind, really showing some remarkable new models after you know such a short time, was one of the one of the great tragedies. A profound tragedy in American civic life.
You know, and I'll let you come in as well. One of the things that struck me about Chakwe Lumumba, and one of the reasons I was so looking forward to interviewing him, was we're working on this piece now that we hope to finish by August on Fannie Lou Hamer and on the legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer and taking it to Chakwe Lumumba and trying to paint
he
this
referred
thread.
To himself as a Fannie Lou
yes,
Hamer
he did.
Democrat.
Exactly.
Yes, he did.
So I was about to
yes,
say exactly,
did.
Exactly. And I think that is, you know, this small-D democracy that people in Ukraine are looking for, that people who are libertarians are looking for, and many people on the left are looking for. May have different visions of what that means, but I think that's, in many ways, what people like Chakwe Lumumba represent, with people who are this new vision that's coming out of coming out of some of our urban centers across America, even through the South, all through the South and everywhere else, of how we run our lives ourselves without being run by either large government or by large corporations. And I think that's this weird thing of the unity, John, that you talk about sometimes that doesn't always connect directly but has some connection.
Well, can I just because I think you've got onto something really big there. And I would invite our conservative listeners to go and take a look at, you know, Chakwe Lumumba's speech to the Alabama legislators who were in town.
Right.
And it was this incredibly smart, nuanced, connected dialogue that actually touched them. And we so often portray, a mayor of a big city as somebody who's going to be at odds with his state legislature. I don't know if he could have bridged those boundaries. I know that some of them were going to be difficult. But I think that one of the most fascinating things that he kept trying to do it on the basis of ideas and innovations. And one of his innovations was the notion of worker ownership, cooperatives, really bringing some rural models for cooperative development into the city. There was stuff going on there that, you know, you could do documentaries for the rest of your career on some of the ideas that were coming into play. And we can only hope that as he is replaced, and there will be a special election, I believe, to replace him,
right,
that his replacement will be someone who hopefully picks right up where he was and kind of keeps it going.
I know Chakwe's son is running. I don't know who he is or much about him, but I know that he's
running. He's a lawyer. In fact, his son has followed very much in many of his traditions. And so I think the son has a real potential there. But, you know, it's not to endorse any one player or to say somebody's the right player. It is to say that whoever the next mayor is, I mean, I think this guy, in an incredibly short amount of time, had a transformational effect on how people think. And, boy, you know, when I cover politics at the national, state, and local level, I want to see a lot more of that.
Yeah, and I think what I appreciated most about his presence is this commitment to stay true to self.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the New York Times article that did a piece on him, he's quoted as saying, Fannie Lou Hamer was a militant, Medgar Evers was a militant, Martin Luther King was a militant, and in pursuit of good interests, there's nothing wrong with it. And so he was very comfortable to be recognized as a militant or recognized as a radical because he also understood that was true to who he was, but it also was true to the ideas, the radical ideas that can encourage change for the positive for communities. And I think that's what his commitment was to
Jackson. Let me just make a rhetorical
point.
The fact that somebody is called a radical does not mean that they have a lot in common necessarily with those who centuries or decades ago were called radicals. In other words,
I don't make that claim.
Okay, okay, because I mean that's what we call in rhetoric a false equivocation of terms, and it's a way to claim that you're linked up with people with whom you're not linked. You know, just if I make one quick personal point, I considered myself and consider myself a strong supporter of Martin Luther King, and yet there are all kinds of people that link themselves with him now that we have nothing in common politically.
Yeah, right. I think that Mayor Lumumba, had he served longer, might well have filled a similar role. Because, of course, one of the things that happens with Dr. King as we talk over time about him is we see as Walt Whitman used to say, he contained multitudes. There were many sides of him, the spiritual man, the academic, the activist, the militant, but also the peacemaker. And it is interesting that you bring up Dr. King. I think it's very relevant. Lumumba was profoundly affected by King's assassination. It was around that time that he changed his name
mm-hmm.
and decided to go south to kind of make all these commitments as an activist. And to his death, in his interviews, he went back to King again and again and again. And I think this is something that we are lacking in American politics, and that is these broad figures who are not easily pinned down, who contain multitudes and who bring many, many aspects to a conversation. These are the kinds of people who can make the connections rather than falling into the trap of one narrow ideology or one narrow political talking point. That's, again, it's weird. We come full circle because we started talking about CPAC and our troubles with CPAC, or at least mine.
Right.
It just was an idea-based. And then here we find this mayor down in Jackson, Mississippi, who seems to be exciting and energizing on all sorts of fronts.
Well, I mean, we were all kind of very shocked when that happened. I was just blown away and stunned. And we went the next day and did a program to talk about Shockwave because of this. He was one of those people that we were all so excited when he was elected mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, and to see that happen. And it was just heart-rending for me, and I hope that his son, who may be running, will pick up that torch, if that's the person to pick up the torch.
Right.
So let me ask a question that's really not about politics, but I want to ask you all this question because we can't really comment on this too deeply, but I get all these emails and phone calls from people who are concerned about the Malaysian flight that went down and nobody can find. And I think about what our responsibility is to how we talk about that, because people are fearful about this, about what it might mean, about knowing what happened. Why are technologies not working? How could it just go down? Then all the other theories about being taken by aliens or whatever people come up with that they think about. I mean, so this is something, though, it's a very serious thing, and people are really wrestling with this. These are things that frighten human beings when we can't explain what went on.
Well, we can't explain immediately, and there is some consternation because normally at this point we would have more information. But I think that some of the more sophisticated writing on this that lists of possibilities, I mean, there's no extraterrestrial interaction in this situation. You know, I think there are always people who will, who will find that. I do find some of the theories intriguing. I mean, I find this intriguing, not fearsome so much. People who are speculating on the possibilities, which they'll be able to do until we know. The apparently, you know, some are making a linkage to the fact that there must have been some cooperation from the pilot. They linked back to a 1999 Egypt Air flight in which the pilot purposely downed the plane. And I find this fascinating. I don't find because I don't understand what happened.
Right.
I don't find it threatening.
Well, I don't know. I don't either. I'm just saying, but I can feel it there.
Yeah, but we are in a culture of fear, and we thrive on that, and the news media help encourage it. So, I mean, maybe individually, many of us are not fearsome, but in terms of the culture as a whole, so much of what becomes newsworthy and gains our attention is because of fear. And being in the era of terror, this encourages us to have these speculations about what was the case with this particular plane, and does it have something to do with terrorism? We have, again, we don't have any knowledge of exactly what has occurred with this plane, but because we don't, it does seem to reverberate in such a way that it creates more and more fear.
What everybody finds incongruous is the fact that we have so much information in this age, and therefore to have something about which experts are saying we don't know strikes people as inexplicable.
John? We have so much information, but we know so little. I just want to echo Richard's point there, for if I can, and really all these points that have been made. I think one of the most damaging things that has happened to the American discourse in the last 20 years is the jumping on someone or stepping up to say, well, maybe this happened, right? And we have immense pressure to be very, very careful in our dialogue about tragedies and accidents. There's a difference between being careful and being responsible. I think we should be responsible. We should say what we don't know. But it is, especially in a time when people are fearful, it is appropriate and fine for media and for individuals to explore possibilities, to talk about them, maybe take them apart, you know, reveal what's unlikely, but also, you know, go to what is unanswered. And I think that we really, and Richard, I think, was getting to this, I think we should be comfortable, more comfortable with those moments where we don't know the answers, but we want to know them. And we should talk about it. We should explore it. One of the reasons why so much of this sort of broader, freer dialogue has collapsed is because journalism has collapsed.
Yeah.
So many instances. Historically, you know, 20, 25 years ago, when advertising supported a lot more media, you had a lot more reporters who went out and camera crews that went out to follow stories. Now we have a lot more people sitting around commenting on stories, including us right here.
Right.
And you know, boy, I'll tell you this, one of the best treatments for fear and uncertainty is a lot of journalism, a lot of going in and looking at things in a very open, very serious way. And as we've, you know, decreased the number of daily newspaper reporters, as we've decreased the number of broadcast reporters, closed down bureaus, done less and less, especially internationally, I think we've ended up in some very unpleasant places as regards the quality of our dialogue.
Right. I think there's a lot to that. I didn't think that John and I would agree on so much. But I do think the closing of foreign bureaus, I think there's an awful lot of people talking and commenting and fewer people doing the hard journalistic work, finding out what is exactly going on.
But, I mean, again, going back to that point about the culture of fear, I mean, that creates consumers. That creates businesses where people all of a sudden run to certain things because of this fear that they have of X. And so the fear of what has happened to this plane has created a audience base that's sitting around watching to see what's going to unravel about the show.
I'll tell you something else that's really interesting. People in a situation like this are worrying how they're going to reconcile what has happened with their ideology.
Mm.
And it may be completely non-ideological, but people are wondering, I wonder what conservative points of view this is consistent with. I wonder what progressive points of view this is consistent with. And they're all afraid because they don't know yet.
I think all that is very true. And one thing we didn't get a chance to get into today, but we'll do next time, we're going to do very soon, the next couple of days, is talk about the Keystone pipeline, which we did not get to, XL pipeline. But we will get into that, and maybe with some of these same people in this panel and others coming up in the next week, because this, I think, massive demonstrations are about to take place around this. We'll see how this really fits into our economy, what it means about our future, about the Earth. I've posted a video that Valerie sent me this morning on the Keystone Pipeline. You can go to Mark Steiner's show face page and look at that. And we're going to be coming back then. I meant to get to that in our roundtable today. We did not, but we will the next time. I want to thank all of you for being here. This is always great. This was a great discussion today. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, great to have you. Glad we could get you when you were back in Baltimore for a day.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Always.
Assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC, author of Black Bears and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. My good friend, Dr. Richard Vatz, professor of rhetoric and communication at Towson University, author of The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion.
Everybody should buy. I'm just saying. Thank you, Mark.
And our dear friend, John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for Progressive and In These Times, associate editor of The Capital Times, The Daily Paper of Madison, Wisconsin, and co-author of the book Dollarocracy, How Money and Media Election Complexes Destroying America. You can see that extended interview that we have done with both of those men on our website at steinershow.org. And thank you all three so much.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Mark. And thanks to my fellow guests.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're going to take a brief break as we go out here for just a moment. We're going to transition with Charlie Parker's Salt Peanuts. He died on this day. Go ahead, Charlie Parker. And we will come back with our interview with Baynard Woods. It's time, that time. What's in the city paper?
Salt Peanuts. Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts. In the name of the salt. Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts.